Someone made a rule. Maybe it was, don't sleep with anyone we both know. Maybe it was, you have to tell me within 24 hours. Maybe it was no sleepovers. Maybe it was something more specific than that, a whole document with bullet points and subcategories and contingency protocols. And the other person agreed, said yes, signed on. And for a while, it felt like safety. But I want you to sit with something before we go any further. Who wrote that rule? Whose anxiety was it for? And did the person who said yes actually have a choice? Or did they say yes because saying no felt like threatening the whole thing? Rules in E&M get dressed up in the language of agreements all the time. They come with rationale. They come with good intentions. They come wrapped in the vocabulary of ethical non-monogamy, which is a vocabulary a lot of us are still learning. But a rule and an agreement are not the same thing. The difference between them is not semantic. It lives in the body. It lives in the power dynamic. It lives in who holds the pen and whose nervous system gets managed at whose expense. I'm a sex therapist. I spend a lot of time in rooms with people who are doing the real, unglamorous work of building non-monogamous relationships. And the thing that trips people up most consistently isn't jealousy, it isn't scheduling, it isn't even communication. It's rules that were never really agreements, and the quiet cost of carrying something you didn't actually choose. Today, we're pulling that apart. Welcome to Untamed Ember. I'm Dr. Misty. Today, we're getting into one of the most common and under-examined dynamics in E&M, the difference between rules and agreements. Why they get conflated, what actually distinguishes them, and what it costs when a rule gets handed down instead of an agreement getting built. This episode is for anyone who's ever agreed to something they weren't quite sure they actually chose. And it's for anyone who's ever made a rule thinking they were protecting the relationship when what they were really doing was protecting their own nervous system at someone else's expense. Let me start at the origin, because rules don't come out of nowhere. They come out of a nervous system that is scared. Not bad scared, not manipulative scared, just human scared. Scared that the love they have isn't going to survive contact with this new structure that they're building. Scared that the territory feels too open or too undefined or too full of possibility in the direction of loss. When your nervous system is sitting in that kind of activation, the kind that comes with opening a long-term relationship or navigating your first experience of non-monogamy or watching your partner develop feelings for someone else, it starts problem solving. It looks for something to hold on to. And almost every time, the answer that it arrives at is some version of control. If I can define the edges, I can manage the inside. If I can establish what's allowed and what isn't, then I can reduce the uncertainty to a manageable size. If I can make sure the territory is bounded enough, I can stop my nervous system from running every worst case scenario on loop. That logic makes complete sense from the inside. I want to say that clearly before I complicate it, because there's a tendency in the E&M community to hear any critique of rules and translate it into, you're doing non-monogamy wrong. That's not what this is. The impulse toward structure when you're scared is not a flaw. It's a nervous system doing exactly what nervous systems are designed to do, find safety. The problem isn't the impulse. The problem is what happens when we mistake one nervous system's safety strategy for a shared agreement. Most of us didn't grow up learning to distinguish between our own nervous system's needs and what we impose on a relationship. We grew up in systems, families, schools, religious institutions, culture at large, that organized safety around compliance. You know the rules, you're okay. You break them, you're not. Safety and behavior became synonymous. And that wiring doesn't just disappear because you read The Ethical Slut and decided you believe in E&M. So when we come to non-monogamy carrying all of that conditioning, the first tool we reach for is a rule book. It's familiar, it's legible. It feels like something you can hand to someone and have them understand. The trouble is that what we're actually handing them is our nervous system architecture dressed up as a shared framework. Let me introduce you to Mara and Dev. They're a vignette built from patterns I see across my clinical work, not real people. Myra and Dev have been together for 4 years. They've been monogamous their whole relationship. About 6 months ago, Dev started bringing up the idea of opening things. Myra wasn't opposed. She had complicated feelings about it, some curiosity, some anxiety, a lot of questions she hadn't fully sorted out yet. But she was willing to talk. Dev, to his credit, didn't push when she was hesitant. He did research. He read books. He came back to the conversation a few weeks later with what he called a framework, a thoughtful, considered list of parameters. Don't sleep with anyone we both know. Tell me within 24 hours of a new connection. No sleepovers. No repeat partners without checking in first. And when Myra looked at this list, she felt something she would later describe to me as relief. Not because the list was right for her, but because someone had figured out what the rules were. The work had been done. She just had to say yes. So she said yes. And Dev said, "See, I knew we could work through this together." But what actually happened in that conversation is something I want to slow down on because it's not what either of them thought it was. Dev brought his nervous system to the table. Dev had spent weeks metabolizing his own anxiety about opening the relationship, running scenarios, figuring out what felt tolerable and what didn't, building a structure that would allow him to feel okay. Those rules were the output of that process. They were the product of Dev's internal regulation work. They were his nervous system's architecture. And Myra had been handed the finished product and asked whether she could live inside it. That is not a collaborative process. That is one person's nervous system work being presented as a shared framework. So what's the actual problem with that? Myra said yes. Dev was thoughtful. The list wasn't punitive or extreme. What's the real cost? So the cost is this. Rules don't regulate your nervous system. They outsource the regulation to your partner. When Dev made that rule, tell me within 24 hours, he wasn't actually learning to sit with uncertainty. He was engineering a situation where the amount of time he had to sit with it was minimized. He was creating a mechanism that would reduce his activation by giving Myra the job of managing it. She became the lever he pulls to feel okay, and Myra agreed to pull that lever. That works for a while. Compliance can look a lot like safety. As long as Myra is following the rules, Dev's nervous system gets a version of what it was looking for. But here's what doesn't change. Dev still hasn't learned to regulate. His window of tolerance for uncertainty hasn't expanded. His capacity to sit with not knowing hasn't grown. The rules gave him a workaround, not a skill. And workarounds require someone to maintain them. Rules also carry a power dynamic that we don't talk about enough in E&M spaces. Specifically, who holds the pen? When one person generates the architecture and the other person agrees to it, what you have is not a partnership. What you have is a proposal and a response. And the person who drafted the proposal had weeks to sit with their needs, clarify their thinking, figure out what they actually required. The person who received it had approximately one conversation. And I know some of you are already thinking it. Isn't it possible for the second person to just push back? To say, actually, I don't agree with this one? Yes, in theory. But the social and relational pressure in that moment is significant. Especially when the person who made the list is your long-term partner who has done the research and is presenting this as their best attempt at making something work that they need. Saying no, actually, to their framework can feel like saying no, actually, to them. Like you're the obstacle, like you're the reason this doesn't happen. That's not a neutral context for negotiation. Here's another thing that rules do that I think is underexamined. They create a compliance culture inside the relationship rather than a communication culture. And those two things lead in completely different directions. In a compliance culture, the operative question is, did we follow the rules? Did Myra tell Dev within 24 hours? Yes. Did she avoid mutual acquaintances? Yes. Then we're okay. The relationship is safe. We can relax. In a communication culture, the operative question is, does this still work for everyone? What's coming up for me that I haven't named yet? What do I notice in my body when we're navigating this? What still needs to be renegotiated? That second orientation treats the relationship as a living thing that requires ongoing tending. The first treats it as a structure that only needs to be checked for compliance. And compliance cultures make it very hard to say when something isn't working. Because if you're in compliance, you're supposed to be okay. There's no official channel for, I agreed to this and I'm discovering it actually doesn't work for me. So I want to address the counterargument I hear most often, because it's a real one. Especially for people who are just opening up, don't they need more structure? Isn't some scaffolding necessary when you're building something from scratch? Yes, absolutely. I'm not arguing against structure. I'm not saying that early E&M couples should navigate everything on pure vibes with no agreements. What I'm saying is that structure and control are not the same thing. An agreement can be every bit as specific, every bit as bounded, every bit as clear as a rule. It can have timelines and parameters and check-in protocols. The difference is not the level of detail. The difference is whether both people actually built it. Whether both people came to the table with open questions and co-authored something together. Whether the structure serves the relationship or whether it serves one person's nervous system at the expense of the others. So let's actually turn the lens around, because naming what rules do wrong is only useful if we can get specific about what doing it right actually looks like. So if rules aren't the answer, what does an actual agreement require? What makes something genuinely collaborative rather than just a rule with a conversational wrapper around it? I want to start here. An agreement requires two people who are regulated enough to actually show up to the conversation they're supposed to be having. Not fully healed, not perfectly calm, not free of any activation whatsoever, because that bar would mean no agreements ever get made. But regulated enough to be present. Regulated enough to hear what your partner is actually saying, rather than what your scared nervous system is expecting them to say. Regulated enough to notice what's happening in your own body and at least begin to name it. That's a higher bar than it sounds, because here's what actually tends to happen. One or both people enter the conversation with their nervous system already running hot. Maybe they've been thinking about this topic all day and they've pre-activated. Maybe the conversation gets brought up in a moment that's already charged with something else. Maybe just the topic itself is enough to send someone into a mild threat response. And then they try to negotiate. What happens when two dysregulated people try to build a shared framework is that they don't actually build one. They each fight for the framework their nervous system already decided on, and the one with more relational leverage tends to win. And the one who wins walks away thinking they made an agreement, while the one who conceded walks away carrying something that doesn't quite fit. This is why one of the most underrated E&M skills is knowing when you're not in a state to have a productive agreements conversation and being able to say so. Not as avoidance, not as a way to delay indefinitely, but as genuine self-awareness. Like, I notice I'm activated right now. I want to have this conversation well, which means I need to settle first. Can we come back to this on Thursday? That's not withholding. That's taking the conversation seriously enough not to wreck it. An agreement also requires that both people have equal standing, not identical needs or identical perspectives, but equal standing to bring what they actually need to the table. Equal right to say, that doesn't work for me. Equal right to bring a need that might feel inconvenient or high maintenance. Equal right to push back on something that's already been proposed without that pushback being treated as a threat to the relationship. Equal standing is harder to create than it sounds, especially in long-term relationships where one person tends to hold more social or emotional power, or where one person is the initiator of the E&M exploration and the other one is the responder. When you're the one who wanted this and your partner is trying to meet you there, there's inherent relational pressure on them. Their yes might be genuine, but it's rarely coming from a fully level playing field. Good agreements account for that dynamic. They don't just wait for the less powered person to push back. They actively make room. They ask, is there anything about this that doesn't work for you? Not once as a formality, but genuinely with space for a real answer and with the willingness to actually change something based on it. The third thing I want to name is that agreements have a built-in relationship to time. They're understood to be current, not permanent. They're based on what both people know, feel, and need right now, with the explicit understanding that right now is going to become a different right now. Rules tend to calcify. Once they're in place, questioning them starts to feel like questioning the relationship itself. There's a momentum to compliance. If we've been following this rule for 8 months and everything has technically been fine, bringing up a change can feel like introducing instability where there was none. But technically fine and actually serving everyone well are different things. And an agreement that was made in month one of opening a relationship is based on the information both people had in month one. It doesn't automatically know what to do with who you both are in month 12. Real agreements don't just allow for renegotiation, they expect it. They're built with the understanding that they'll be revisited and that revisiting them is a feature, not a failure. So let me come back to Mara and Dev because I want to walk you through what it looks like when a rules-based framework meets the actual texture of a real open relationship. About 4 months in, Mara started dating someone. She was following the rules carefully. She told Dev within 24 hours. She wasn't seeing anyone they knew. She was checking in before they made plans. She was doing everything right. And Dev was still miserable. Not because Mara had broken anything. Not because there had been any violation. She had been in full compliance. Every box was checked. And his nervous system was still running the same loop it had been running before they opened. Still anxious, still churning, still waking him up at 2 a.m. with the same circular thoughts. Because the rules hadn't fixed anything. They had given him something to watch. And watching is not the same thing as trusting. Watching is the surveillance version of trust. It looks like faith, but it's powered by vigilance. Meanwhile, Mara was exhausted in a way she couldn't quite name. She was managing a new relationship, which takes real emotional bandwidth, while simultaneously monitoring her own behavior for compliance within a framework that she hadn't designed. She was doing the labor of being Mara in a new connection, plus the labor of managing Dev's anxiety through correct behavior, plus the labor of not quite being able to say that she hadn't really agreed to any of this in the first place. And she was getting smaller. And the smaller she got, the more isolated she felt. Because how do you name something like that? How do you say, I agreed to this, but I think I agreed because I had to, not because I actually chose it? Especially to someone who worked hard to make that framework thoughtful. Especially when naming it threatens everything that they've built so carefully. The cost of retrospective dissent, which is the clinical term I use for when someone says yes because the cost of no was too high, is that it gets paid slowly in installments over months in the form of growing resentment, shrinking self-expression, compliance that becomes more hollow, the quiet exhaustion of carrying something that doesn't fit. What eventually cracked it open for Mara was a conversation that happened almost by accident. Dev came home one night, could tell something was off, and asked directly. And instead of the reflexive, I'm fine, she said something she'd been sitting with for weeks. She said, I think I agreed to your rules, but I don't think we actually built this together. I'm not sure the way we set this up actually has me in it. I said yes because I wanted to make it work, not because I actually had a voice in what we were making. Dev's first instinct was to defend the process and to point out how careful he'd been, how much research he'd done, how he'd asked her if it was okay. But he held back because somewhere in him, he already knew that she was right. What Mara named is one of the most important things that can happen inside an E&M relationship. She named the gap between formal consent and felt consent, and those are very different things. Formal consent is the absence of a no. Felt consent is the presence of genuine agency, the sense that you actually participated in creating what you agreed to. Not just that someone offered you a structure and you accepted it, but that you helped build the structure and it has your fingerprints on it. Formal consent is the foundation. Felt consent is what you're actually trying to create. The conversation that followed was not comfortable. It required Dev to acknowledge that the architecture he'd thought was mutual wasn't. That his version of "we talked about it" had been closer to "I build it and she said yes." That his felt sense of being in this together had been partly a story he was telling himself. That's really hard to hear. That's the kind of conversation that can feel like an indictment. But it's also the only conversation that was ever going to actually change anything. Because the discomfort of a real conversation is finite. The discomfort of carrying retrospective dissent is indefinite. That's where Mara and Dev got to. And it's a real place to get to. Now the question is what you actually do with it. So practically speaking, how do you move from rules to agreements? What does that shift actually require? The first thing I'll say is you can't skip the backward conversation. Before you can build something new, you have to understand what the old structure was actually for. Because if you just tear up the rules and say, let's start over, you'll rebuild the same thing with different words. The anxiety that generated the original rules is still there. The relational dynamic that allowed one person to author the framework is still there. The backward conversation sounds like this. Where did this rule come from? What were you scared of when you made it? What were you trying to prevent, and did it actually prevent it? And for the person who agreed, what did you know in that moment that you didn't say? What were you hoping would become okay over time? That conversation is worth having even if the rules have been working. Because sometimes working means complying, and compliance isn't the same as fit. For Dev and Mara, the backward conversation took some time. Dev had to get honest about the anxiety that had generated his list. Not present it as logic, just name it as fear. The fear that Mara would discover she preferred someone else. That openness would expose something in their relationship that couldn't be fixed. That once the territory was open, he wouldn't be able to get it back. Naming that out loud changed the conversation, because now they weren't talking about the rules. They were talking about what the rules had actually been protecting. And Mara could respond to that directly instead of just accepting or rejecting the framework. The second thing the shift requires is that both people bring their actual needs, not their positions, their needs. Positions are what we've already decided we want. Needs are what we actually require to feel safe enough to be present in the relationship. Mara's need wasn't, "I don't want rules." Her need was, "I want to feel like I have standing in this relationship. I want my experience to be something we track and care about, not just something that gets checked for compliance. I need Dev to be doing his own regulation work rather than expecting my behavior to do it for him." Those are needs. And they're different from positions because they have room in them. Dev could hear her needs and respond to them. He couldn't do much with, "I don't want your rules," except feel defensive. What Mara and Dev eventually built together looked from the outside a lot like Dev's original framework. There was still communication. There was still structure around how they navigated new connections. There was still a check-in protocol. But it had different roots. Mara had helped build it. Her needs were in it. The pieces that had only been serving Dev's anxiety without actually serving the relationship had been renegotiated. And both of them knew they could come back and change any piece of it if it stopped working. The form was similar, the function was completely different. And the biggest difference wasn't in the document they'd made, it was in Mara's body. She stopped feeling like she was carrying Dev's anxiety. She started feeling instead like someone whose experience mattered inside her own relationship. So here's the practical starting place I want to offer if any of this is landing for you. It's a question, not a checklist. The question is, whose nervous system was this made for? Not as an accusation, just as an honest inquiry. For every agreement or rule in your relationship structure right now, whose nervous system was it made for? Did both people build it? Did both people actually have a voice? Does it still reflect what everyone in the relationship actually needs? If the answer is no, or I'm not sure, that's not a crisis, but it is information. And information is the beginning of the conversation, not the end of the relationship. I want to leave you with something to sit with between now and the next time. Think about one agreement or rule in your current relationship structure. Just one. and ask yourself honestly, did I build this with my partner or did I agree to something that was already built? And if you're the one who tends to be the architect, the one who tends to bring the framework to the table, I want to ask you this. Can you imagine bringing open questions instead? Not your answers, your questions. What are you scared of? What do you actually need? And can you sit with not knowing what the structure is yet long enough to actually build it with someone instead of for them? If any of this is landing and you have something you want to send me about rules that turned out to be agreements, about the moment you named retrospective dissent, about what it felt like to actually build something together, I'm listening. You can find me at hello@untamedember.com. Next episode, we're getting into what actually happens in the body when you open an existing relationship. Not just the logistics, but what shifts in your nervous system when the relationship you thought was one thing starts becoming something else. It's a rich one. Before we close, I want to give you somewhere to land with this. I want to invite you to notice right now if there's something you agreed to that you didn't quite choose. Not necessarily in an E&M context, just in your life, in your relationships, in the structures that you've said yes to. Something where you signed on because the cost of saying no felt too high, or because someone needed it so clearly that your own answer just got quiet. Just notice if that's there. You don't have to do anything with it right now. And I want to invite you, if you are in a relationship with agreements, to feel into what it would mean to have a real voice. Not hypothetically, in your body. What does it feel like when you're in a conversation where both people are genuinely building something together? Where your no is as welcome as your yes? Where you're not just being asked to respond to someone else's architecture? Hold that for a second. Notice where it lives in your body. Notice if it feels familiar or unfamiliar. And here's what I want to leave you with. Your nervous system doesn't need perfect rules. It doesn't need airtight agreements. What it needs to know is that it has a standing in the relationship, that you can bring your real hesitation, your real need, your real self to the table, and that the person on the other side is willing to build with you, not just hand you something finished and then ask if you can live inside it. That's what agreements are actually for, not to control behavior, not to manage anxiety through compliance, but to create enough genuine safety that everyone in the relationship gets to show up whole. This has been Untamed Ember. I'm Dr. Misty. Rules come from one nervous system's anxiety. Agreements come from two people who both get to be in the room. Subscribe to the Untamed Ember newsletter at untamedember.kit.com for deep dives, bonus material, and the behind-the-scenes content that does not make it into the episode. Next episode, we're getting into what actually happens in the body when you open an existing relationship. What shifts, what doesn't, and why the nervous system sometimes treats change like a threat, even when you genuinely want it. We'll see you next time.